The Sunstone Foundation presents Dale Morgan and Mormon History, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
From Dale L. Morgan's correspondence concerning Mormon history. William Mulder is professor of English at the University of Utah, where he has taught since 1946. The university gave him a Distinguished Teaching Award in 1977. His Ph.D. in the History of American Civilization is from Harvard University. He has been the editor of the Western Humanities Review and was founding director of both the Institute of American Studies and the Center for Intercultural Studies at the University of Utah. In 1978, he received the Distinguished Service Award from the Utah Academy of Arts, Sciences, and Letters. He is the Academy's President-elect for 1987. Hopefully, too, there will be enough time following the two presentations to allow questions from the audience.
Thank you, Gary. The story of Dale Morgan in Mormon history is a story with a sad ending. It is sad because of a number of personal afflictions that Dale suffered in his life. His father died when Dale was 5, and his mother was left to raise a family of small children. When he was 13, he suffered meningitis, which left him deaf. Later in his life, Dale also struggled with eye problems, which frightened him with the prospects of being a scholar, unable to see a manuscript or hear it read to him. His early death at the age of 57 halted a number of important projects which had fired Dale's imagination and driven him through the early years of his career. Sad because it is the story of a brilliant scholar and his unfinished masterpiece. It is sad also for Mormon history, which lost the fruits of a thorough historical investigation by one of America's leading historians of the West. When I say one of America's leading historians of the West, let me explain. Dale Morgan's reputation is generally as a researcher and historian in fields other than Mormonism. His outstanding biography, Jedediah Smith and the Opening of the West, is used as a textbook. The first time I ever heard of Dale Morgan was in David Miller's Utah History class at the University of Utah. On the first day of class, Dr. Miller raised up the Jedediah Smith book and said, "Here is the textbook for this class. It also happens to be the best biography written by someone born west of the Mississippi. It may be the best biography written west of the Atlantic Ocean." I wrote this statement in my class notes. Whether or not one agrees with that assessment, one cannot avoid the fact that Dale wrote or edited 38 books dealing with the opening up of the Western American frontier. His book, The West of William Ashley, was considered by Dale not only his best work, but he felt it merited a Pulitzer Prize. Unfortunately, nominations for the Pulitzer Prize have to be made by the publisher, and Fred Rosenstock, his publisher, missed the deadline for submitting the Ashley book for consideration. To these books may be added at least 54 book reviews he wrote over the years for a variety of publications. Between 1945 and 1957, he worked as Saturday Review's reviewer on the West, Utah, and the Mormons, writing 29 reviews for them. Along with his books and reviews, he also published numerous articles on scholarly subjects. My unofficial count is 26 other articles besides his reviews. The scope of the books and articles reveals the range of Dale Morgan's interests. He wrote on a wide variety of subjects, which included the Gold Rush of 1849, the exploration of the Colorado River, pioneer and immigrant trails, the Great Salt Lake, the Humboldt River, the mapping of the West of William H. Ashley, Jedediah Smith, Caleb Greenwood, life in the Hawaiian Islands, the fur trade, etc. In a review of the Jedediah Smith book, the New Yorker magazine aptly described not only the book they were reviewing, but also described all of Dale's writings when they observed, "Mr. Morgan has tracked down every scrap of information about Jedediah Smith and has done a full-scale reconstruction of a commanding figure and a period of great ferment and vitality." Morgan was known, tracking down every scrap of information and using it in full-scale reconstructions of the life of his subjects. Thus far, I've been speaking about the well-known side of Dale Morgan. But my presentation today is about Dale Morgan as a Mormon historian, and I believe he is one of Mormonism's most important historians. There are three areas which Dale contributed to Mormon history. Although they overlap, I have broken them down into three general categories. The first category is what he referred to as the tool books. The tool books were basic research materials necessary for any scholar of Mormonism. When Dale first became involved with the Utah Historical Records Survey in 1938, his first job, he realized that there was an absence of reference materials for Mormon historians. In the Historical Records Survey and later at the Utah Writers Project, a division of the WPA, Dale wrote historical sketches of several counties in Utah. At the same time he was preparing the county histories, the Historical Records Survey was involved in two other projects. One of these was to record all of the titles of books published in Utah from the beginning of printing in the state up to 1890. The other was to make an inventory of the various religious denominations in the state. To some extent, Dale was involved in the work of each of these projects. He began the bibliographic study in the Ogden-Carnegie Free Public Library, and then in 1939 he moved to Salt Lake City. As he worked on the bibliography and the inventory of the churches, he noted with some frustration the unhappy state of source material for Mormon scholars. Because of the absence of bibliographical lists of Mormon works, there was no way of knowing what had been written about Mormonism or where a given book could be found. Dale observed that, quote, "the resources of the wide world of scholarship were essentially unavailable in Utah to the student of 1940. There was a fairly well-lighted room for work at the church historian's office, if one had entree there, or the Salt Lake City Free Public Library and Brigham Young University. But basically, it was impossible to write definitively on any topic relating to Utah or the Mormons. If one knew that relevant titles existed or once had existed in the outside world, blind search after them was the only real expedient. As for tapping distant repositories by microfilm, if you did succeed in locating an item and could have it filmed, he didn't think there was a viewer within 1,000 miles of Salt Lake City other than at the LDS Genealogical Society. And photostatting entire books or pamphlets very quickly ran into real money. While Dale worked for the Writers Project, he was also beginning two other important projects for Mormon history. One was a part of his job in the WPA, collecting and preserving journals and diaries relating to Utah and the Mormons. It is difficult to ascertain exactly what he discovered, but he knew a good item when he saw one, and over the years he passed along a number of primary source documents which were published in other writers' books. He was extraordinarily generous in this type of activity. This generosity may be illustrated by quoting from a typical offering of his. This went to Juanita Brooks in 1941. She was doing research for the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Quote from a letter from Dale to Juanita. "I am sending you herewith something that will be far more interesting to you than anything I could write as a letter. About 11 this morning, I wandered around to the church historian's office to see if by any chance they had the history of the Santa Clara Mission. Jacob Hamlin says he handed in. There was nothing in the history of the St. George Stake. I then asked Alvin Smith if he knew of such a history in manuscript. He couldn't recall anything of the sort and was doubtful that they would have it if it wasn't in the journal history or stake history. I then asked if they had any of Hamlin's journals. He looked up the index and found that they were supposed to have a mutilated journal by Hamlin. Most obligingly, he looked through a couple of steel cupboards and gave it to me. Naturally, I was highly delighted. I sat down at a typewriter there in the office, I borrowed some paper, and without so much as 5 minutes intermission, hammered the typewriter for 6 hours. I got up with the complete copy of the journal that I send you. Please take every care of this because there is no carbon copy." His correspondence is filled with references to items he located and passed along to other researchers. These documents were the first of his tool books in Mormon history. The second contribution of the tool books was his pioneer work in Mormon bibliography. When he left Utah in 1942 to work in the war machine in Washington, D.C., Dale carried with him the idea of developing a bibliography of the churches of Mormonism. He discovered that the nation's capital was a mecca for research materials about Mormonism. As he began doing research during his spare hours, he made a fetish of copying with the most minute notes the card catalogs of the libraries in which he worked. The main source for his card catalog search was the Library of Congress. Later, he made trips to New York City to copy the card catalogs of the New York Public Library. In 1947, Dale embarked on a nationwide trip to the libraries and sites of Mormon history, where he completed his bibliographic studies. At some point, he decided that the Mormon bibliography should be broken into segments. At the suggestion of my respondent today, William Mulder and Harold Bentley, Dale published a series of bibliographies of the lesser Mormon churches. The Western Humanities Review published these bibliographies in three issues between 1949 and 1953. But Dale's comprehensive bibliography of the Mormon Church from 1830 to 1849 was not published in his lifetime. He did send his copy of it to the Utah Historical Society, where it was typed in quadruplicate so that it could be accessed as an author catalog as well as a title, chronological, and an imprint date catalog. He was also the moving force behind the first Union catalog of works about Mormonism. Later, others took the Union catalog and expanded it from the 700-entry list, which covered 1830 to 1849, to the much larger work which Chad Flake published in 1978. The Third Tool book is perhaps the least known and in some ways the most interesting of Dale's reference library for Mormon historians. In the 1940s, he began concentrating on making transcriptions from the newspaper collections of the Library of Congress. When he made a year-long pilgrimage across the United States in 1947 and 1948, one of his major projects was to read every newspaper in every area that the Mormon Church had been located. By the end of the summer of 1947, he was able to claim that he had read virtually every newspaper in the Library of Congress published before 1849 in Ohio, Vermont, Illinois, Missouri, and Iowa. He was convinced that there was, quote, hardly a phase of trans-Mississippi history for that period that he could not rewrite. By the time he had finished his transcontinental search, he had visited every major and minor library along the Mormon Trek. At each stop, he added to his collection of newspaper articles on Mormon subjects. These transcriptions were kept in a file, which Dale called The Mormons in the Far West. In 1949, when Dale was in a bit of financial trouble, he sold carbon copies of the set to Huntington Library, Yale University, and the Utah Historical Society. This newspaper collection is a rich resource, frequently ignored, which provides a documentary view of early Mormon history from, in many cases, the earliest and closest sources to the events. With Dale's keen sense of the undercurrents which moved Mormonism along, he included numerous items which illuminate themes in Mormon history. Let me give just one example that I discovered when I was reading the transcripts. My interest in the newspaper files was in the environment which Mormonism was born. When I read the transcripts, I found numerous references which Dale had excerpted relating to such things as people seeing visions, the Indians being Hebrew, and lost treasures being found before 1830. Dale did a great amount of legwork, or should I say field work, which does not need to be duplicated. In this same area of transcriptions, Dale also made a great many extracts from the LDS Journal history while he had access to the Church Historian's Office between 1940 and 1942. Although access to this material is no longer as restricted as it once was, as late as 1971, Dale wrote that the material which he kept in a set of binders was irreplaceable. He felt at that time that the Church would not allow anyone to copy the journal history as he had in the early 40s. These tool books may be the most important contribution which Dale made to Mormon history. The newspaper transcriptions, the bibliographic work, and his work locating and collecting unpublished source material were important activities from which anyone involved in Mormon history can benefit. Research tools are so much better today than they were 40 years ago that it is easy to forget that the transcriptions of the 75 volumes of the Niles Weekly Register, for example, had to be pounded out by hand on a typewriter and not merely Xeroxed. When one examines the hundreds of transcriptions that Dale made, one realizes how Dale advanced Mormon research. But he did not only collect materials for other scholars. All of his efforts to gather historical material were for one purpose, his definitive history of the Mormon Church. Early in his work at the WPA, he had decided to write a major history in three volumes about the rise of Mormonism. By 1942, the project was sufficiently formed in his mind that he wrote to Juanita Brooks, quote, "For the last several years, I have been soaking up everything about Mormons I could find. Nothing was without significance. Any problem existing for anybody in Mormon research was a problem also for me. Those people, and I have encountered a diverse group with whom I came in contact, supply me with provocative viewpoints on this major interest of my life. In answering their limited needs, I answer larger needs of my own. All these individual things are parts of an infinitely complex organism that I am trying to see whole. I didn't begin this research with that end in view, but things have developed that I believe I am now capable of writing that definitive history of the Mormons and this state that has been so badly needed. I am not yet ready to write it, but I believe that I am fortunate enough to have the equipment. I have an emotional understanding of Mormonism. I also have an intellectual detachment essential to the critical appraisal of it. My work of the historical record survey and the writer's project during the last 4 years has been, in effect, a fellowship in the history of this state. I have a pretty good educational background, and I have sunk enough time in research to have a pretty extensive command of the resources. So you see what these things add up to." What they added up to was that Dale was to spend the next decade trying to write Mormons. Shortly after Dale wrote that letter to Juanita Brooks in 1942, he left the Writers' Project in Utah and moved to Washington, D.C. In his evenings and on the weekends, he worked in the book, manuscript, newspaper, and map collections of the Library of Congress, and in the staggering and largely unplumbed manuscript collections of the National Archives. In January 1945, Dale applied for a post-service fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation to finance the completion of the Mormon history. Feeling that he needed 2 years to complete the project, 1 year of field research, and at least 1 year writing the book. In the spring of 1945, he was informed that he had been awarded a $2,000 stipend from the Guggenheim Foundation for 1 year, with a possible $2,000 renewal for an extra year. For the rest of 1945, he made plans to resign his post at the Office of Price Administration as he was pushing himself to finish his research in the libraries of the nation's capital. He spent the remainder of 1945, all of 1946, and most of 1947 finishing his exhaustive newspaper research in the Library of Congress. In the fall of 1947, Dale activated his Guggenheim grant and quit his job in the federal government. In October 1947, Dale set out in his 1943 Hudson for a cross-country study of Mormonism. His first stop was New York City, where he spent 6 weeks in the New York Public Library and the New York Historical Society, working principally in the newspaper files. In New York, he almost bankrupted himself making microfilms of early Mormon publications, such as The Return, The Elder's Journal, The Gospel Herald, The Prophet, The Messenger and Advocate, and The Evening and Morning Star. Throughout the remainder of 1947, Dale made his way through the New England states where Mormonism was born. Following New York, he struck out for Vermont, where he retraced the meanderings of the family of Joseph Smith. First he went to Woodstock, then Windsor, where about 136 years previous, Solomon Mack, Joseph's maternal grandfather, had published a pamphlet, Narrative of Solomon Mack. Then he went down to South Royalton to the old Smith farm. He wrote of this visit, "The air today was winey and fresh, wholly delicious, the very smell of October in the hills. The rolling adjacent land seemed still to be farmed after a fashion. I noticed that the soil was rocky still. I climbed over a barbed wire fence north of the place and climbed the higher of the hills looming above it until checked by a more formidable barbed wire fence. I didn't think it worthwhile to climb, as I had altitude enough for the picture I wanted. I noticed that in this field above the old farm was a good deal of cutover land with small stumps to give me an idea of some of the problems this land may have afforded when the original stand of timber was cleared off by the Smiths. Scenically, The place was lovely, even at this season, when the grays and russets and duns of November reign in the hills, for the hills still were carpeted by a brave, fresh green of grass. From Windsor, he drove 5 miles to Tunbridge, where the Smiths also lived for a time, then from Tunbridge to Sharon, Sharon to Norwich, Norwich to Whittingham, and the old Brigham Young farm. From Vermont, Dale went to Massachusetts, where he spent several days in the Library of Boston, the libraries of Boston. It was now November of 1947, and Dale was literally following the paths that Mormonism had forged as it snaked its way through New York State, through Pennsylvania and Ohio, and out west. Dale spent Thanksgiving that year near Afton, New York, where Joseph Smith married Emma Hale in 1827. Then he went to Colesville, site of an 1830 trial of Joseph Smith, and then to Harmony to see where Joseph and Emma had buried their first child. Late in November, Dale visited Palmyra, where the Book of Mormon was published, Kirtland, Ohio, and the first Mormon temple followed after New York State. In Ohio, Dale spent several days at the Western Reserve Historical Society, discovering an extensive newspaper collection of Ohio imprints. He moved on from Cleveland to Detroit, where he worked in the Burton Historical Collection at the Detroit Public Library, particularly on items relating to the prophet of Beaver Island, James J. Strang. From Detroit, he went to Chicago, where he discovered affidavits concerning Joseph Smith's life that had been collected but not published by A.B. Deming in his publication Naked Truths About Mormonism. He also found in Chicago the Kirtland Bank stockbook. After a few days, he moved on to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. From Fort Leavenworth, he made research forays to the many churches of Mormonism in that vicinity. The reorganized church was nearby in Independence, as were several small offshoots. Dale visited the RLDS church's headquarters at Independence, Missouri, for several days and was given permission by Israel Smith, president of the RLDS church, to examine anything in the library, including photostats of the Book of Mormon manuscript. During the day that Dale spent examining the manuscript, with the help of S.A. Burgess, the research assistant at the RLDS library, Dale concluded that their manuscript was the second or printer's copy of the Book of Mormon. Dale was also allowed to examine the Hiram Page seer stone. S.A. Burgess gave a demonstration of how it was used, holding it up to his eyes and peering through it. But Burgess said he could not make it work, and neither could Dale. Dale examined such curiosities as the characters from the Book of Mormon and was allowed to read the Book of John Whitmer, an early official history of Mormonism, and the original printer's copy of the Book of Commandments. Toward the end of January 1948, having finished his visits to the churches around Independence, he continued his expedition, brief excursions to Columbia, St. Louis, and St. Joseph, Missouri, and Nauvoo, Illinois, followed after which he headed west and south, where he retraced the Mormon battalion route to California. In California, he concluded his transcontinental trek at the Huntington Library, the Stanford University Library, and the Bancroft Library. From Northern California, he returned to his mother's home in Sugar House, where he arrived in March of 1948. He had completed the most extensive library research project in Mormon history to that time. His work in the field was essentially finished, and now he was prepared to spend the next year to 18 months writing the first volume of his Mormon history. But it was not to be. When he arrived in Salt Lake City, there was a letter waiting for him, which he had not expected. It was from the Guggenheim Foundation, notifying Dale that the second year fellowship, which he was planning on to support him while he wrote the history, had been denied. It was a serious blow. He had resigned his job with the federal government to work full-time on the Mormon history. He noted that now he would have to start again, not from scratch, but some distance back of scratch. He was in the middle of the project and was both out of funds and a job. While Dale cast around trying to earn a little money to keep himself going, he received the second major blow to his Mormon history. Earlier, he had contacted Israel Smith, president of the reorganized LDS Church, for permission to use the archive materials in the RLDS library at Independence. He had likewise written to George Albert Smith, president of the LDS Church in Salt Lake City, requesting similar cooperation from the church historian's office in Utah. In a letter dated April 14, 1948, Joseph Anderson, secretary to the first presidency, replied to Dale Morgan's request. Quote, and experience running over several years has persuaded us of the unwisdom of giving access to our manuscript records to people writing books, because that same experience has shown that people writing such books are rarely qualified to appraise accurately what they read. And too frequently, whether conscious or unconsciously, they misrepresent what they find. Such manuscripts will therefore not be available for general inspection nor use, the historian's office being not a research library, but a private library maintained and operated for the benefit of the church. End of quote. The Utah Church would allow Dale Morgan access to some printed materials in the library, but not to manuscripts and not even to first or rare editions of books. Of course, he was disappointed by the refusal of the Utah Church to allow him access to their research materials. It was the first rejection he had encountered from any library across the country or any of the several churches of Mormonism. But Dale did take them up on their offer to look at their non-rare, non-first edition books in order to complete his bibliography. He was surprised at the time to find, of his 700 titles in the bibliography, only about 190 titles were at the church historian's office, a smaller number at the headquarters of the church than he had found at the New York Public Library, the library at Harvard, or at the Coe Collection at Yale. Dale was now, in mid-1948, looking for ways to earn a living. The Mormon book was placed down the line of priorities while he attempted to stay financially afloat. He wrote John Selby of Reinhardt and Company in July 1948, requesting an advance on the first volume of the Mormon history, promising the first draft of the book by April 1949. But even as he wrote, he was becoming more involved in raising the water table of my financial well, as he put it, by accepting projects that stole his time from his Mormon history. In 1949, he decided to leave Utah again. On September 6th of that year, he wrote his friend Dean Brimhall, "In the last month, my decision has definitely crystallized to return to Washington, D.C. permanently, insofar as I am able to establish myself. The year and a half I have spent in Utah has graphically demonstrated to me that it is wholly unrealistic of me to try to maintain myself here. Both economically and culturally, it is impossible, or if not impossible, unwise and impracticable. Apart from the cultural handicaps under which one must work here, the basic tools of research not even at hand, the economic disability serious. What it amounts to is that I should either have to give up the writing of the histories, for which I have prepared myself through so many years, or be content to live forever at a worse than substandard subsistence level." Later, in 1949, Dale returned to Washington, D.C. In March of 1950, he wrote Fawn Brody that he had completed about 125 pages of his Mormon history, plus a 19-page appendix on Joseph Smith's 1826 glass-looking trial in Bainbridge, New York. He sent this portion of the manuscript back to Utah, where it was typed at the office of the Utah Historical Society. Throughout 1951, he worked intermittently on his Mormon history, eventually completing about 7 chapters and 2 appendices of that work. To his publisher, Farrer and Reinhardt, he submitted only 3 chapters and 1 appendix. When he left for Washington, D.C., he did not have a job waiting, so besides trying to finish the history, he was also doing whatever work came his way, consisting mainly of writing review articles for Saturday Review and cataloging manuscript collections for the Eberstadt Company in New York. A letter from his publisher in January 1952 completely stopped the work on the Mormon history. Stanley Reinhardt wrote Dale scolding him for his slow progress. Reinhardt pointed out that Dale had been working on the project for 17 years, 4 years under contract with them, during which time they had only received 3 chapters from Dale. Reinhardt noted acidly that the project was not only 2.5 years past the projected completion date, but that, quote, "the volume of correspondence about the book far outweighs this amount of manuscript." Reinhardt was no longer committed to publication of the Mormon history. Stunned by the nastiness of the letter, which made him bristle all over, he left his apartment that morning and went over to the Library of Congress. There he worked all through the day. At night, he returned to his apartment and wrote his friend D.L. Chambers. the president of Bob's Merrill Publishing Company. Chambers, who had been extraordinarily kind and courteous through all their relations, had expressed several times to Morgan that he wished the Mormon book was available for Bob's Merrill to publish. In Dale's letter to Chambers, he requested an immediate $750 advance, which would buy out his old obligation from Farrer and Reinhardt. Dale did not offer for the advance his History of the Mormons. He asked that the advance be paid for a contract on the Jedediah Smith biography. The Mormon History was traded for the biography of Jedediah Smith. Later that month, Dale wrote to Madeline McEwen, "I have many times regretted that I committed myself on this book when, as it proved, the circumstances of my life were such that I was not able to make good on the commitment, and as I have not been willing to throw a text together to satisfy a merely legal obligation, I have been in a cruel situation." The Mormon History had not survived this series of blows in Dale's life. First, the loss of the Guggenheim Fellowship renewal. Second, the refusal of the Utah Church to grant access to research materials. And third, the request for a return of the advance by Stanley Reinhardt. For the rest of Dale's life, he referred to his Mormon History, which he would someday finish, but he never did. There are only 7 chapters and 2 appendices, which he did write. Knowing the amount of work that went into their preparation makes them even more interesting. He wrote these chapters at approximately the same period of his life that he wrote the Jedediah Smith biography, and the chapters reveal an artist and a scholar in command of his material. The text of the chapters cover the early history of Joseph Smith before he organized his church. When one realizes that it was written before 1952, it is clear that Dale added much to the historical record concerning Joseph Smith. Dale combined his sure-footed writing style with his perceptive insights to produce a history more firmly rooted than any previous history of Joseph Smith in the early documentary sources of the period. The final area of Dale's contributions to Mormon history is revealed in his correspondence. It is clear from reading the letters of Dale Morgan that he acted in a capacity of patron saint to a number of historians throughout his career. The letters are a warm testament to Dale's humanity and brilliance and exhibit his many roles as historian. They also display the many facets and problems which Dale encountered in Mormon history. One role which Dale played with great facility was that of a counselor to authors with works in progress. Fawn Brody sent Dale drafts of No Man Knows My History, which Dale returned with long instructions on expanding her section on Nauvoo to give the whole book more coherence. He also suggested she make a final evaluation of Joseph Smith's character, but at the same time evaluate the hold, the magnetism which Joseph Smith had with his followers. He gave them, Dale observed, something they never got from anyone else. He left an indelible impression upon their minds, and they gave him a love they had never given anyone else. Brody was then cautioned to carefully evaluate every area in the book that could lead to criticism of her judgment in what was sure to be an intensive examination following publication. Like Devoto invited Dale to help him make his books more watertight. And a raft of others wrote to Dale for a suggestion and received an annotated outline by return post. Sometimes he went beyond advisor and became a backstage agent for a writer. In February 1944, he took it upon himself to promote the writings of Juanita Brooks. He wrote to Madeline McEwen, "I want to tell you about Juanita Brooks in a new book of which I am what you might call the spiritual father. Some weeks back I got to thinking about Juanita, her valiant and rather extraordinary life, her remarkable knowledge of the history and folkways of the southern Mormon frontier, and so on. Accordingly, I wrote her that she was commanded to write a book, in some degree autobiographical, but with a large basis of social history, a kind of passionately personal book about the life she knows so well. I outlined in general what the book would be, and I told her that her whole life had literally been a preparation to write it. Well, the idea struck fire in her mind, and she now sends me 30 or 40 pages she has dashed off. The material is absolutely wonderful. She tells some of the most marvelous stories you ever heard. But more than that, the tone of all she writes is warm, human, witty, and wise. And as I have just written her, it is full of sunlight." The material Dale was referring to grew into Juanita Brooks, Juanita Brooks's Quicksand and Cactus. The book was not published until 38 years after this letter was written, a decade after Morgan's death. Dale was midwife to Quicksand and Cactus and several other works by Juanita Brooks. He maintained an active collaboration on each of Juanita's major projects. These included the Mountain Meadow Massacre, John D. Lee, and the Diary of Hosea Stout. Nor was Juanita the only recipient of Dale's comprehensive, but sometimes nitpicking, assistance. For several years, he supplied a steady stream of material for Madeline McEwen's still unpublished massive biography of Brigham Young. It is clear from the letters to McEwen, Brooks, Brody, and others the degree that Morgan could be helpful to a fellow researcher. The historian's correspondence is the quintessence of Morgania. The letters are long and lively, containing his anecdotes, observations, and speculations, mixed with a rich smattering of his latest finds in the correspondence field of interest. They constitute an intellectual history of Mormonism during that period. The Morgan of greatest interest is Morgan as critic. My favorite illustration of Dale as historical critic occurred following the publication of Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History. The book had been reviewed by former Utahn Bernard DeVoto in the New York Herald Tribune Books on December 16, 1945. In the review, DeVoto had referred to his own view that Joseph Smith was a paranoid. If you think that the controversy of Joseph Smith is between people who think that Smith was a prophet and people who think Joseph Smith was not a prophet, then you might be interested to see how much heat can be generated in a debate on whether Joseph Smith was a paranoid or a fraud. Morgan wrote a censorious letter to DeVoto, which ran 7 pages, closely argued and single-spaced. Morgan accused DeVoto of misrepresenting Brody's book and letting his preconceptions about Joseph Smith influence his judgment. DeVoto's reply to Morgan was filled with invective against Dale. The letter from DeVoto has been published in The Letters of Bernard DeVoto by Wallace Stegner. When DeVoto finished his bombulation against Morgan, he then wrote to Fawn Brody, "Dear Mrs. Brody, in common with God knows how many others, I have frequently wished that I didn't write books. Today I could almost bring myself to wish that you didn't. For this morning I took half a day off to write Dale Morgan about yours, and the afternoon's mail has just impelled me to take the other half day off and write you about it. And the last day I could afford to take off was back around the turn of the century." DeVoto's response to Morgan led to another 7-page letter from Morgan, this time less provocative and signed cordially, but still a pointed criticism of DeVoto's paranoid thesis. "I think," Morgan said, "it would be close to impossible to write a book-length study of Joseph Smith which would seriously maintain the paranoid thesis and show forth his life as exemplifying it," Dale wrote to DeVoto. However one feels about Joseph Smith and his claims, whether the reader falls into the nondescriptive categories of pro-Mormon or anti-Mormon, or whether one is ambivalent, this debate between two features in the literary firmament must be considered instructive. Whatever one's vantage point, one comes away from the exchange with a realization of the enormous complexities involved in any attempt to understand Joseph Smith and his religion. It is in the correspondence, then, that we get the best view of Dale Morgan, the Mormon historian. The letters show how Dale had a major hand in managing the Utah Historical Society. For a time, detailed letters went out from his Washington apartment suggesting publishing schedules for a year at a time. He gave detailed instructions about what articles would be in the issues, who would write them, what they would contain, and where to find the material. He even recommended that the University of Chicago style book be obtained and that future writers be admonished to use it. His wide array of correspondence meant that Dale was involved with virtually every phase of Mormon history. 2 institutions in Utah have collected fine correspondence files of Dale Morgan. They realized the importance and the readability of Dale's essay-like letters. The Utah State Historical Society maintains letters to Stan Ivins, Marguerite Sinclair, Charles Kelly, A.R. Mortensen, and Todd Behrens, among others. The University of Utah Library has an excellent collection of Dale's letters. Most prominent among those at the University of Utah are Madeline McEwen, Juanita Brooks, and Fawn Brody letters. When Bancroft Library, where Dale worked for the last years of his life, finally gets around to making the 90 boxes of Dale's materials available, which he left them at his death, we may have a virtually complete correspondence file. These, then, are the roles Dale played in Mormon history. First, as a collector of research materials in the form of diaries and journals, which began at the WPA and continued on through his life. He was one of the first, if not the first person, to recognize the need for a union list of Mormon titles, and then set himself about the task of compiling one. Then, as an avid collector of newspaper extracts relating to Mormonism, which led him to collect typescripts of periodical material which occupy 9 boxes at the Utah Historical Society, tool books, which Dale Morgan unselfishly labored to obtain for future scholars. His published and unpublished works are his second contribution, articles, reviews, books, and an unpublished, incomplete manuscript which was written during Dale's prime and would have been a classic. The third contribution was Dale's correspondence, which influenced a wide array of writers about Mormonism. Dale acted as prod, guide, mentor, and scout for a generation of writers, among them Juanita Brooks, Wallace Stegner, Fawn Brody, Francis Kirkham, Bernard DeVoto, Maureen Whipple, and Charles Kelly, that literally turned Mormon history and literature in new directions. It is easy in the correspondence to see Dale's influence in their work. It is impossible to accurately measure that influence. But it was significant. Because of that importance, the letters constitute one of the most enticing reads in Mormon literature. In college, Dale majored in art. He became interested in history, partly of necessity, but it was always his real love. Due to his background and temperament, he was able to combine his training in art with his history. His real brilliance was in his ability to paint history with words. The pictures he drew in the text of his writing are what set him apart as an historian. He was able to combine so many facts in enchanting word pictures. Let me illustrate by closing with the first two paragraphs of his unpublished history of the Mormons. The new place was 2 miles out the Stafford Road, just beyond the Palmyra Township line, in what was soon to become known as Manchester. Overgrown with great oaks, maples, beeches, and basswood, through which the sun struck here and there into fragrant growths of sassafras and wild tangles of raspberry briars, the 100 acres were part of the Everson land, owned by non-resident heirs who left it neglected. No one in Palmyra cared who lived there. In this late autumn of 1818, there were 10 Smiths, small and large, to take up residence on the farm. The tall and supple Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy, his wife, had 6 sons and daughters, with a last straggler, yet unborn, a girl who would be named for her mother. The strapping eldest boy, Alvin, was 20, and the children ranged on down through Hiram, Sophronia, Joseph, Samuel, William, Catherine, to Don Carlos, who was 2. The third son and fourth child, Joseph Jr., was just short of 13 and had first seen the light of day December 23, 1805, briefly resident at Sharon, Vermont. All of the Smith children were tow-haired and blue-eyed. Their paternal grandfather, Asel Smith, who had once predicted that a prophet would be raised up in his family, might well have been baffled had his 8 grandchildren been ranged before him and he required to denominate the prophet from among them. Thank you.
My friends in the audience may wonder what the F in my name stands for. It stands for phony. I have no middle initial. I like the ring and rhythm of John Philip Walker. Mine is simply William Mulder. I'm sure that John Philip is going to lend distinction to his name, judging from what we've heard this morning. It's welcome news that Signature Books is bringing out a selection of Dale Morgan's correspondence. and chapters from his unfinished history of early Mormonism. Mr. Walker, editor of this forthcoming edition, has whetted our appetite and kindled anew our appreciation of Dale's manifold contributions to Mormon and Western historiography. Dale has put every researcher and writer on the Mormons and the Far West since him in his debt, both because of his wide-ranging industry and his fabled generosity. The industry and generosity went together, as Mr. Walker has clearly demonstrated, with Dale modestly disclaiming that whatever grist he was grinding for others also fed his own mill. Mr. Walker gives us a revealing passage from one of Dale's letters to Juanita Brooks. You remember it. "Any problem existing for anybody in Mormon research," said Dale, "was a problem also for me. In answering their limited needs, I answered larger needs of my own. All these individual things are parts of an infinitely complex organism that I am trying to see whole. I am myself a beneficiary of both Dale's generosity with his materials and the example of his method in trying to see whole." It was on a tip from Dale to the publisher Alfred Knopf that Russell Mortensen and I were putting together a collection of observers' accounts about the Mormons, that Mr. Knopf, passing through Salt Lake City in the early 50s with his wife, Blanche, called us from the airport, invited us to lunch at Beau Brummel on Highland Drive, and after chit-chat that curiously never mentioned our project, put the prospectus for our book in his pocket as he left and said we would hear from him. Within days, we did, in words now historic to our ears. "I am inclined," he wrote, "to take a flyer on your book." Several years and many vicissitudes later, Among the Mormons appeared, with one of its inclusions an essay by Dale on the contemporary scene. The essay, in fact, forms his unsurpassed introduction to Utah, A Guide to the State, that had appeared in 1941, and opens with the memorable line, "The Mormon habitat has always been a vortex of legend and lie." Several other notable inclusions in Among the Mormons came from the early newspapers Dale had ransacked for Mormon items at the Library of Congress and the New York Public Library, and in every state on the way west during that cross-country trek in his old Hudson in 1947-48 that Mr. Walker describes, an epic copying spree on an equally old typewriter, a labor of Hercules that provided scholars with a major resource, an indispensable tool book, to use Mr. Walker, or is it Dale Morgan's apt term, long before the Xerox revolution. It was hard to be one up on Dale in terms of historical finds, and it gave Russ Mortensen and me no end of pleasure to discover that the letters of Governor Alfred Cummings' wife, Elizabeth, which on a tip from Ray Canning I had tracked down in the manuscripts division of Duke University Library, were new to Dale. "Could I get a print of your coming microfilm?" he asked Russ. "That is a mighty fetching lady, and I want to know her better." The request followed as a footnote in a letter of April 7, 1958, in which he endorsed Among the Mormons with a warm comment that the whole thing was brought off with a sense of style, he thought, but with a warning that he had been asked to review it for John Coy's Pacific Historical Review. "So," wrote Dale, "I will have to check up on what you have deleted as well as what you have put into it. Let us hope the book will stand up under this investigation." Dale was a professional and would not allow friendship to compromise criticism. His review did, in fact, find some shortcomings in our anthology. He found the early section, Genesis, a bit overloaded with excerpts by Mormons themselves, perhaps, he charitably observed, because articulate outsiders were not always conveniently at hand during the successive crises in New York, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. And he also found that we had often leaned upon reminiscences rather than the exactly contemporary record we would doubtless have preferred. At the same time, he found that the selections gave the general reader a living sense of earliest Mormon history. In the section called Chronicles and Judges, dealing with the first decades after the Mormons arrived in the Valley, Dale found the gravest weakness our selection of an address by Juanita Brooks recounting the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Her remarks are indeed moving, he wrote, but within the framework of this book, the editors might better have printed one of the accounts written by the investigators of 1858, 1860, or even portions of John D. Lee's confession. So we were duly chastised, and I hope you don't mistake what I've quoted his saying about Juanita Brooks to be a judgment on the book, Mountain Meadows Massacre. This was an address summarizing, memorializing, recounting. Not a criticism of her work, but of our choice in something as late as that rather than the contemporary document. I have dwelt, perhaps too personally, on Dale's connections with Among the Mormons to illustrate his godfathering, a care and concern, both personal and professional, he displayed toward dozens of other projects besides our own. In his correspondence, Dale was the patron saint Mr. Walker finds him to be, and he was the explorer. Dale's letters are explorations, the intellectual equivalent of the travels of his mountain men, filled with his forays into libraries in the field, alive with information and agendas, acute observations, creative speculations, restless searchings as he maps the historical and literary landscape of the Mormons and the West. What he says of Jedediah Smith and his opening of the West may be metaphorically applied to Dale's opening of Mormon and Western historiography through the labors Mr. Walker has described. Dale prefaces his Jedediah by saying, "He entered the West when it was still largely an unknown land. When he left the mountains, the whole country had been printed on the living maps of his trappers' minds. Scarcely a stream, a valley, a pass, or a mountain range, but had been named and become known for good or ill. A new kind of American, the mountain man, had come into existence during those 8 years, and Jedediah Smith and his associates," he said, had the shaping of him. Substitute Dale Morgan himself for Jedediah Smith in this description, scholars for mountain men, and Mormon and Western historiography for the actual topography, and we get a suggestive figure, by no means far-fetched, of the magnitude of Dale's achievement. David Atkinson and Gary Topping, who have prepared a description of the scope and content of the Dale Lowell Morgan collection at the Utah State Historical Society, remark on Dale's tenacious devotion to accuracy in even the minutest detail, as well as his curiously limited conception of the nature of the historical process. History to Dale Morgan, they say, meant primarily geographical movement. Larger social forces and the role of personality did not entirely escape him, but he was always at his best when meticulously reconstructing the route followed by a mountain man or emigrant party. On occasion, they say, Morgan let his passion for minutiae trap him into applying major emphasis to relatively minor points. And they cite the time Dale wrote to Marguerite Sinclair, then at the Historical Society, this was June 22, 1944, suggesting she do history a service and ask Charles Kelly to write a piece for this year's Quarterly, demonstrating that Escalante actually crossed at Padre Creek, not at the crossing of the Fathers. Dale may have suffered the faults of his virtues, but meticulous reconstruction and passion for minutiae have proved to be salutary correctives in Mormon and Western history, so often the preserve of the well-meaning but undisciplined amateur. Dale's insistence on factual accuracy and verbal precision served his larger aim of seeing the whole, the total environment, physical, social, cultural, intellectual, of a time and a place. His environmental method, his dogged pursuit of the background of the background of the background, got him into trouble with Bernard DeVoto, whose review of Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History, already referred to, provoked a sharply critical letter, which Mr. Walker has already sampled. DeVoto called it a blast. It will be worth the price of the signature book edition of the Morgan Correspondence to get Dale's side of the exchange. DeVoto's angry reply on December 28, 1945, fills 8 pages in Wallace Stegner's edition of the letters of Bernard DeVoto, the edition that appeared in 1975, published by Doubleday. Stegner's commentary only whets the appetite. The irritation evident in DeVoto's reply, says Stegner, though some of it had been simmering for a good while, reflected partly the heat of argument and partly the profound differences in personality and historical method between the two. DeVoto didn't think Dale understood metaphor. Stegner says Dale may have been somewhat baffled by DeVoto's difficult and elusive style. And DeVoto objected to Dale's listing, quote, mistakes in DeVoto's review that weren't mistakes. I could not, said DeVoto, imagine anyone's understanding them as mistakes. I had never experienced the kind of mind that could think of them as mistakes. There was no way my mind and yours could meet over them. DeVoto confessed to flowing naturally into psychiatric judgments, to being warped and riven and tied in a double lover's knot in that direction. He called himself a spoiled psychiatrist and hazarded the guess that Morgan was a spoiled sociologist. At least it appears to me, he said, that when you have found an environmental explanation of something, you are content. You feel that you have settled matters and depart about some new and proper business, whistling in the carefree consciousness of a job well done. DeVoto told Morgan that there are a very great many things in Smith and in Mormonism which I cannot accept your explanation as explaining. It seems to me, he said, that your vast factual knowledge of Mormonism, your enormous store of data, rests on and is implemented by conceptions that have only a verbal meaning. You deal with pure verbalisms as if they were realities as solid as bricks. What seems to me to weigh a pound seems to you to strike C sharp, and there is no way of bringing us to discuss things in the same terms. DeVoto warned Morgan to look to his own preconceptions and to be a little more careful of his own statements of fact. But most particularly this, he said, when you think of Smith as a product and exemplar of his times, take care that you sufficiently realize that those times did not, anywhere outside his church, center on him. In short, if you are going to deal with him on the basis of what seems to you a historical theory, but is, if I diagnose it aright, a sociological theory which accepts only a static psychology, then make sure, make a damn sight surer than it appears to me you now do, that you avoid the cardinal fallacy of practically everyone who writes about Mormonism. That fallacy, said Devoto, consists in overstating the importance and the typicalness of Mormonism in the United States of its time. It was not, Devoto maintained, typical of American life at that time. And it was, even in sum total, of exceedingly minute importance in or to American life. It is at best a minor thing in America as a whole, and at best an aberration of the principal energies involved in it. Obviously, Devoto was not what Richard Bushman would call a faithful historian. Something of the state of mind of the true believer, Devoto was persuaded, seems to linger on in everyone who writes about Mormonism. Devoto's parting shot was that he would not acknowledge that Dale's ideas about American life at large in the first half of the century were any more authoritative than his, or rested on any more intimate or detailed knowledge. Stegner assures us that squabbling was not their characteristic relationship. Both before and after this altercation, says Stegner, Devoto drew on Morgan's encyclopedic knowledge of the West and the fur trade and valued him both for his learning and for his generosity with it. We all did, says Stegner. I have lingered over the exchange because Mr. Walker, in alluding to it, teases us into wanting to know more, but leaves us, as Romeo left Juliet, so unsatisfied. Devoto once confided to Garrett Mattingly, another eminent historian, "I can't ever be a historian, for I hate detail and can't spare the time for original research. I'm a journalist, my boy. I'm a literary gent who can be a nice press agent for history." Both Devoto and Morgan, however, took Francis Parkman as a master of narrative history to heart. And Parkman knew, as Van Wyck Brooks said of him, that no good writer has ever liked drudgery, nor has any good writer ever permitted anyone else to do his drudgery for him. Dale Morgan was a good writer and did his own drudgery. A comparison with Parkman may illuminate Dale's career. Both were heroic historians. Some of you know Mason Wade's Life of Parkman called Heroic Historian. Both were heroic historians, heroic in a double sense. They were heroic in overcoming crippling handicaps, Parkman's nearly total loss of sight, and Dale's complete loss of hearing. And they were heroic in their grand designs. Parkman, the prolonged conflict between England, France, and Spain for the mastery of the New World in the context of events in the Old. Dale, the exploration and settlement of the West and the rise and movement of the Mormons in the context of national events. Both turned their handicaps to advantage, Parkman's near blindness intensifying his pictorial imagination, Dale's deafness freeing him from distractions and compensated by his artist's eye for shape and color. They were strenuous men in a way Teddy Roosevelt would have admired, dedicated and driven like Jesuits as they buried themselves for months in libraries and archives, or hit the trail for the exhilaration of standing on the sites where history was made. Both were pioneers. Parkman, taking his cue from Irving, made the writing of American history significant at a time reputations, like Prescott's and Motley's, rested in an established interest in European history. Dale made the local and regional history of the Trans-Mississippi West significant, tracing the tributaries that fed the mainstream of national history. The Humboldt, the Great Salt Lake, Jedediah Smith, William H. Ashley, Catholic Fathers, Mormons, 49ers, and Overlanders. All parts that would eventually make the whole greater than the sum of these parts. Names without the ring, perhaps, of Bunker Hill and Bull Run, the Alamo and Little Bighorn, but magnified and luminous in Dale's artful narrations and vivid descriptions. Dale, so often the hack in order to earn a living, never wrote like one. He had style and a sense of humor. Afflicted as he was, unable to hear the tones of his own voice, much less another's, he spoke in a high-pitched monotone, many of you will remember. Words pouring out in answer to questions and fragments put to him on scraps of paper. I remember using up a pad of 3x5s in conversation with him once on a park bench in Washington, D.C., when he sat by the hour like a patient academic Bernard Baruch, sharing his wisdom. Dale once described Washington, by the way, as a historian's paradise, and the National Archives as enough to make one weep with joy. Dale was quick in repartee, the wit often satirical, flashing in conversation as it did in his letters. In one letter to Russ Mortensen, dated 19 July 1951 and preserved at the Utah State Historical Society, he responded with a question and a quip to the news that the society might be moving to the Kearns Mansion. How fireproof is the place, he wanted to know. And how sure could the society be that its collection would be safe? A burned-up governor is easily replaced, but not so a library. I hope you include that one in your selection. The photograph of Dale Morgan that accompanies Everett Cooley's admiring and affectionate memorial tribute in the Utah Historical Quarterly for winter 1971 looks at once severe and serene, even benign. The face of a man who has taken his own measure in success as well as adversity and knows his worth. Had Alvin Gittins painted Dale's portrait, as I wish he had, he would have caught the unflinching look in Dale's eyes, the granitic purpose in repose in the square angles of his face, the hint of an enigmatic smile at the corners of his mouth, the strength of the stubby fingers closed around one of his books. In the photograph, the hands do, in fact, rest with deliberate weight on an upended copy, spine forward, of The West of William H. Ashley. The iconography is fitting and completes Mr. Walker's image of Dale Morgan as patron saint of Mormon and Western historians. Dale Morgan, says Dr. Cooley, was a man of many ideas and more projects for himself and others to do than could be undertaken in a half dozen lifetimes. Dale compressed more projects into his too short life than many of us would do were we given a dozen lives. Thomas Jefferson wanted only three of his achievements memorialized on his tombstone: his authorship of the Virginia Act of Religious Toleration, his drafting of the Declaration of Independence, and his founding of the University of Virginia. Dale Morgan would be glad to be remembered, I think, for the three major contributions Mr. Walker has identified in his very informative paper. One, his tireless collecting of original source materials. to his grandly conceived and superbly written histories, and three, his seminal correspondence. There's still the role of Dale Morgan as literary critic to be considered at a future symposium, maybe. But for today, his epitaph might read, in the manner of the elegies on headstones in the graveyards of colonial New England, though dead, he lives in works heroic, memorials of a spirit stoic. Thank you.
I believe we have about 15 minutes left. Is that right? Then if there are any questions...
I don't know if everyone could hear that. The question was, did J. Reuben Clark have any influence in the cancellation of the Guggenheim grant? J. Reuben Clark wrote a letter to the Guggenheim Foundation in, I believe it was 1949, asking them not to help Dale Morgan's Mormon History Project in any way. He did not influence the Guggenheims, but it was not for lack of trying. Dale had been notified in 1948 that he would not receive a renewal, and I don't think he ever applied again, and I've never seen any information that the Guggenheim people wanted to approach him to give that. So, no, he didn't influence their decision, but, yes, he did try to. Well, I think what he meant, he described in other letters his feelings about Mormonism, in that he had been born and raised in the Mormon Church. His family were Mormons. He was a descendant of Orson Pratt, actually. But as he got involved in history, he was an agnostic. So he felt that he knew the emotional strains of Mormonism and that he had a sensitivity to that, but that he didn't always just believe the Mormon explanation or the standard explanation of things. Well, I've just made a random check. I haven't really studied who've used those, but I have, in my just checking around, I haven't seen very much use of those. An example, I went through Richard Bushman's book the other evening through the citations at the back. It's an excellent book. Covers virtually the same period of time that Dale does in the unpublished history, about the same period. I didn't see any reference in there from Dr. Bushman using it. I really think it has not been, because of the title, it has not been used very often by scholars. Maybe someone has a better idea of that, Bill. Right. They're at the Utah Historical Society. They take, I believe it's 9 boxes there. They're at Yale in the Coe Collection. And at, did I say Bancroft? Was that it? Huntington, yes. Which, you know, they'd be more limited at Huntington than the other places. Yes. The question was, when does Bancroft intend to catalog the Dale Morgan Collection, which is actually physically not in the Bancroft Collection. It's in a warehouse several miles away. I asked them, perhaps rather energetically, why they hadn't cataloged. When I was there, they didn't even have a catalog made up. And I asked them when they were going to make it available for scholars, and they said, we haven't even finished cataloging the Mark Twain papers. Dale Morgan is way down the line from that. So it's not one of their prime interests. Perhaps the fact that David Gardner is now in charge of the University of California systems, we could do something about that. But right now there are no plans. It's years away. Well, no, we do have some of those. The way you do that, the way you access that, is you write them a letter and tell them what you want to get out of the collection very specifically. And they go out to the warehouse the day before, find it, and bring it in. It is impossible, though, to root through the system or through the collection and see if you're getting everything. You just have to assume that you've given them accurate descriptions and that the person who found them for you got everything that you asked for. I haven't found them, and I didn't ask for them at Bancroft. I suspect they are at Bancroft. All of his papers went there. All of the other collections are from other people, Madeline McEwen's letters, Fawn Brody's collections. Well, it's even more complicated than that, Lamar. There's, out of those 30 or 40 volumes, several of those he edited with a long editorial essay at the beginning and notes. Others he collaborated on. There might be five or six books he collaborated on. I would, just off the top of my head, I would guess about 20 of those were edited books. Maybe another 5 or 10 were collaborations. And he actually wrote between half a dozen and a dozen books. Yes, he did, actually. He, at least on a couple of occasions, he was fairly praiseworthy of Fawn Brody when she wrote that book. The book came out while he was still in the midst of doing his book. He did refer, he thought that she had done more incisive work and more insightful work on Joseph Smith than anyone up to that point of time. By way of criticism, he did think that she had maintained what he referred to as a hazardous line of assumptions throughout the book. Well, he went to the University of Utah. That's how he ended up an agnostic. He describes that in a letter to his religious metamorphosis or whatever, in a letter to, I think, Juanita Brooks in about 1941, and I think it will be included in the book. But to outline it, and I hope I'm not detracting from anything he said, he was born and raised in a what he referred to as an Orthodox Mormon family, although he added parenthetically that the orthodoxies do change from one generation to the next. But he felt that he was raised in an Orthodox Mormon family and that he was active in Mormonism up to at least the time of his deafness, and that when he became deaf, that his world was turned upside down. And I think it was that and the combination of his studies that turned him into an agnostic. There are a number of references to his religious beliefs and his beliefs about the Mormons. I will add that I have never seen anything. In fact, I've been quite surprised as I've read through the correspondence at how, even though he has no vested interest, he was very slow to make any assumptions about Joseph Smith or the church that were negative. He was corresponding with a man named Stan Ivins for a number of years. Stan's brother, who was in the was a general authority in the church, had seen the headstone of the baby of Joseph and Emma, their first baby. And the brother, who was the general authority, I believe was Anton Ivins, was disturbed because the date made it look like the baby was born before they were married, and he was very upset and told Stan Ivins this. And Stan wrote Dale in the East and asked him to check it out, and all through, where you'd think someone who is an agnostic and maybe looking forward to besmirch someone, Dale just said, "I don't believe it," and it could have been that the baby was premature and a number of things, until he did go and check it out himself, and Dale was satisfied that the baby was born on the date that is accepted. So I think it's a curious intellectual detachment. I think he described it accurately when he said that he felt like a Mormon, but he had a lot of intellectual detachment about the religion itself. Yes? He was born in 1914. Yes, December. Died in 1971 in March.
Was he ever married?
He was never married. In fact, Lamar Peterson wrote a letter to the editor when Dale died, drawing a number of comparisons between Dale and Beethoven. How they were both born in December, both deaf, both died in March, both had never married. But he was engaged to be married when he died, as was Beethoven. Both left a number of unfinished masterpieces, if we can use that word. But he was engaged to be married when he died. Any heirs? He had some brothers who were alive at his death. And perhaps some, and I think some nieces and nephews. Thank you very much.